Since I'm not to jump right over.
Good morning, Montreal. You are tuned to the Wednesday Morning After on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We have a full show for you today filled with two news features, one about landfill waste management and the other about nuclear waste management. We also have a rabble podcast about the new position the government is taking towards Uber drivers. 8 a.m. brings Democracy Now!, 8:15 brings Weather, and we'll wrap up the show. Let's start the day off with some music. A petition has been launched in the Quebec National Assembly concerning waste management for sanitation. This petition closed March 2nd, but we are going to discuss its purpose and ramifications today on the Wednesday Morning After. With us today, we have Denis Blaquiere, a filmmaker specializing in scientific, wildlife, and social issues documentaries. Hi, Denis, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Sheila.
Please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to be involved in filmmaking and the issue of waste management.
Yes, as you told the audience, I'm a veteran filmmaker and specializing in documentaries. And in 2012, I did a documentary entitled La Poubelle Province, which was about the collection, processing, recycling, or destruction of waste materials in the province of Quebec. And what I found was truly shocking. First of all, I discovered that the province of Quebec is generating about 13 million tons of waste per year. Now, that's 25 tons a minute. And I also discovered that each Quebecer generates 15% more waste than an American citizen. So that was quite a shock, and it shocked the audience when the documentary was aired on Radio-Canada at the time. Because not only were we amongst the biggest producer of waste in the world, but we also were some of the least efficient in recycling them. And what's terrible is that this documentary was made 10 years ago, and it's too bad because the situation has not really changed since then. It's even worse today than 10 years ago. So this is why I became involved in all kinds of issues and debate concerning the waste management in the province of Quebec.
Tell us about the giants of garbage and what they are doing to waste management in Quebec.
Well, the waste management industry in Quebec is dominated by a few big companies which specialize in landfilling and burning waste. And the problem is that they do so at rock bottom prices. You know, the tipping fees are way too low. So these big mega dumps are undermining our struggling recycling industry. And this is quite a scandal because we now know that 90% of all waste, all our waste can be recycled or composted. And this is with today's technology. So 90% of all our waste is not garbage, but really they're precious raw materials that can be used again and again by industry and agriculture. And what we see in Quebec right now is that more than half of our waste stream still ends up in mega dumps. And we must not forget that our waste is responsible for about 5% of all of Quebec's greenhouse gas emissions. We must also keep in mind that each one of our mega dumps is an ecological time bomb future generations will have to cope with. But what's even more worrisome right now is the return of incinerators. Can you believe it?
What are incinerators and why are they a part of the problem?
Well, the problem with incinerators is we all thought that we would never see new incinerators anywhere in Quebec. But right now, there is an intense lobbying in favor of these expensive and polluting facilities, which make no sense economically, socially, and for the environment. Because, you know, the incinerators now, they have fancy names, they use fancy new technologies, but their purpose has not changed. It's simply to destroy waste materials that could either be recycled or composted. You know, burning a plastic yogurt container to produce energy makes no sense, since it will cost four times more energy to manufacture a new container. And yet all these incinerator lobbyists are really rooting for to build these facilities. So this is a terrible perspective, and we must fight it at all cost.
Aren't we recycling most of our garbage? What is the cost of a recycling program as opposed to landfill?
Right now in Quebec, you know, municipalities can have contracts for burying anything for about $40 a ton, you know. The problem is that recycling waste can cost up to $200 a ton. So what we're asking the government is to raise the cost of landfilling up to around $200 a ton, you know, or at to the same cost of recycling a ton of waste. This way, the landfilling industry and the recycling industry will be kind of equals, and they can compete with each other. But right now, the main competitor of our recycling industries are mega dumps, and we must stop landfilling everything and anything at all cost in Quebec.
The PAP, a government body responsible for public inquiries about the environment, has a decades-old policy concerning waste management. What is being done to update this policy?
Well, right now we are very thrilled because the province of Quebec is now coming at a crossroads in its global waste disposal policies. We've been asking for decades that the government launch a big, vast national inquiry on how Quebec is disposal policy, and we are very glad because that's what the government is about to do. So the government has mandated the BAP, which is an independent environmental agency, to launch a vast public inquiry on waste disposal in the province. So we salute, of course, this long overdue initiative, but we fear that the government will use this inquiry mainly as a public relation operation to further consolidate the power of the giants of garbage, including the return of incinerators. So we're urging every citizen and group of citizens or organization interested in a more ecological way of treating our waste to participate to this BAP inquiry, which will take place in a month or so.
What are the real solutions that we are looking for?
Well, you know, we're asking all the people to participate to the BAP inquiry because we fear that the government will narrow the scope of this investigation in order to avoid tackling the real problem or implement solutions that will kind of hurt the industry, you know. So here are some solutions we would like the BAP inquiry to propose to the government. We would like to put that the government put a ban on the landfilling or destruction of any material which can be recycled or composted. Can you believe that Nova Scotia did it in 1998? They forbid the landfilling of anything that could be composted or recycled. And 2 years later, Nova Scotia became the Canadian champion at diverting waste from landfills. So there's no problem for the Quebec for Quebec to do the same. Of course, we also want the government to ban the construction of any form of waste to energy facility, including the ones destroying waste chemically to produce fuel. Another thing that we want the government to do is to force institutions, commerce, and industries to collect and recycle their waste. Can you believe that? These institutions, commerce, and industries generate half of the waste stream in Quebec, and it's not mandatory for them to recycle their waste. So we want the government to force institutions, commerce, and industries to collect and recycle their waste. And as I said earlier, another thing is to raise the cost of landfilling to around $200 a ton. And even more radical, if we might say, is to force mega dumps to sort the waste they get before burying them, to put aside anything which can be recycled or composted. Now, you may tell me, hey, this is science fiction, it's impossible, but they do just like they do that at the Otter Lake landfill in Nova Scotia. So if a Canadian landfill can do that, well, we can do that in the Quebec landfills. You know, we often talk about the cradle to grave approach, but right now the waste disposal policy of our government seems to be focusing only on the grave part, focusing only on getting rid of the waste stream. We would propose to the government, on the contrary, to focus on the eco-conception of products so that they can be easily recycled, on reducing our consumption of goods, on reusing, repairing, and recycling, all that in priority, and landfill only the 10% or so of waste that cannot absolutely be recycled or composted. So this is, I'm sure that participating to the BAP inquiry, other groups and people will have interesting suggestion for the government. Now, of course, the BAP is an independent institution. When the BAP will do the final report in about 8 months or so, all these things will be recommendations for the government. These will not be official laws, but the government will have the choice to either take all these suggestions or some of them. But we need at least to put some pressure on the government to counteract the giants of garbage, which have, of course, dozens of lobbyists in Quebec City working very hard to keep our mega dumps filled and to build new incinerators. So, as I said, we are now at the crossroads in Quebec waste disposal policies, and we must act, and our voices must be heard loudly, and so that the government will take the right decision.
If our listeners want more information, where should they go?
We are now forming a new coalition of citizens called the Coalition pour un BAP de solutions écologiques, which is the Coalition for Ecological Solutions to our Waste Management. So we will have a Facebook page in a few days, so that we will have some material there so that folks can get the right information and all that. I would suggest also there are many groups, environmental groups focusing on waste management in Quebec. One of them is the Front Commun Québécois pour une gestion écologique des Québec des déchets. So the Front Commun is the spokesperson for the Front Commun is Karel Ménard. And Mr. Ménard is one of the most, our leading expert here in the province of Quebec. He's been monitoring the waste management scene in Quebec for the last 25 years. So Karel Ménard, you just type that on the internet, and you will right away be directed to the Front Commun. And again, there you will have many information. Of course, in our drive, have more and more people participate to the BAP audience, we will of course ask major environmental groups like Greenpeace and Équiterre to take part also, because you know waste management and greenhouse gases are linked together. So this is it, and Let's hope that the citizens' voice will be heard and that Quebec will cease to waste precious raw materials. You know, I often compare, you know, the way the province of Quebec is dealing with its waste stream to a guy, you know, with a mine. You know, he's mining iron ore, you know. So he mines iron ore for 1 year, and at the end of the year, he takes 50% of the ore and he puts it back in the hole. No, if you saw a miner do that, you would say, well, this guy is crazy. Well, this is exactly what the province of Quebec is doing with his waste material. You know, we're collecting it, we're sorting it, and we're throwing half of it in a hole, you know, and paying good money to do that instead of recycling and using these raw materials to make our recycling industry prosper. So it's important, keep a watch for this BAP inquiry and try to participate.
Well, thank you for your interview today.
No problem, Sheila. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Denis Blaquiere speaking about the recent BAP inquiry into waste management in Quebec. I am your host, Sheila Ferrando.
Early in the morning, before the sun rose, when the first bird sang, even while everyone was still asleep.
Morning. On that morning.
When the sun comes out.
This morning, baby.
Cocky-doodle-doo. I hear the rooster crowing.
Now you must wake up.
Now every morning when I wake up,
I woke up this morning with
the kiss of the morning.
Got up 7:30 every morning. Had the same breakfast.
Réveillez-moi à 8 heures demain matin.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Has this ever happened to any of you, or will it happen to any of you, on the morning after the night before?
You are listening to The Morning After on CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial.
Over 100 public interest groups and community groups signed on to a joint letter setting out their expectations for a review of Canada's radioactive waste policy launched by Natural Resources Canada last November. Top on their list, the review must be transparent and independent of the nuclear industry. With us today, we have the Executive Director and Counsel for the Canadian Environmental Law Association, Teresa McClenahan. Hi, Teresa, and welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Sheila.
First, please introduce yourself and tell us how you came to be the Executive Director and Counsel for the Canadian Environmental Law Association.
Sure, yeah. I have been Executive Director at CELA for going on 14 years and took that role on after a short stint away working for our Environment Minister here in Ontario on the Walkerton inquiry, if you recall that water disaster. And before that had been 8 years at CELA as counsel and about 13 years private practice environmental law. So I came to the position with quite a bit of diverse background in environmental law.
I get the idea that this is about people's rights to a fair process and review. Please explain the goals of this petition.
Right, so a letter to the Minister of Natural Resources. And what we were saying in the letter is that the topic of radioactive waste management, the policy, is a really important topic. We've got a policy over 20 years old. And in that policy, there was very little detail. And so last year, the International Atomic Energy Agency conducted a country review of Canada, which is normal, but said to Canada, you need an actual complete radioactive waste policy. So that was announced, and Canada committed to doing that. But when Canada undertook that review, it did so with fairly brief set of questions and discussion papers on a website, and with a strong role for industry in formulating the policy or strategy in a way that we didn't think was appropriate. So yes, we have put out this call asking for a number of things: adequate time to conduct the review, you know, good input from the public, full transparency, in other words, whatever's influencing the policy and whoever's input, whether it's industry, nuclear industry or otherwise, or public, needs to be made clear so that civil society can respond and provide our advice, because we represent groups across the country who've worked, many people for decades, on serious issues involving radioactive industry, whether that be mining uranium in Saskatchewan or operating nuclear power plants in Ontario or dealing with the very, very dangerous radioactive waste. So our concern was that there was inadequate role for the public in the way the review was announced, and a need for a much more rigorous review. In terms of the process and the radioactive waste review, another area of concern is the adequacy of outreach and consultation with Indigenous people, especially since many of the projects that are being suggested so far by the industry would affect Indigenous people's rights and traditional territories. And the other thing we're quite concerned about is who the decision maker is, and that needs to be the government of Canada itself and not the nuclear industry that created the waste in the first place. So those are some of the essential points we were making in the letter that over 100 groups sent to the Prime Minister and Minister of Natural Resources last week.
Canada needs a new national radioactive waste policy. What would that entail?
Well, the policy needs to entail a good description of the kinds of waste that are to be dealt with. And there are many, many kinds of radioactive waste, from the high-level fuel waste that comes out of the reactors, which is, you know, toxic for hundreds of thousands of years, believe it or not, right through to very toxic waste that's called intermediate but still lasts for tens or hundreds of thousands of years, very dangerous to the public, right through to things like the tailings left from uranium mining or the legacy contamination in some of the communities where fuel was processed. So it's quite a big, wide-ranging issue, and it entails coming up with approaches that ensure the protection of the public both today and basically for an infinite time frame because of these hundreds of thousands of years of very dangerous levels of radioactivity. And so thinking about things like securing that waste, making sure it's not available for diversion to malicious purposes like weapons, making sure it doesn't contaminate water and the ground, making sure that it wouldn't impact on the ecosystem. And then how do you protect it from accidents, whether they be geological accidents or human-caused accidents? And then an extremely important issue around what is the policy in terms of responsibility and making sure that future generations are aware of what we've left them.
What happens when we don't have transparency in the review process and, in fact, time allotted to people to review and question the policies at hand?
Well, a good analogy would be if you asked any hazardous industry, like let's say oil and gas, for example, to come up with their own cleanup standards and their own long-term storage standards and their own standards around how the exploration sites are to be left, then you might not have confidence in the results of that standard setting process. So it's a similar concern in the case of nuclear power, that you need to have the broader society with government decision making at the end of the day decide on the level of safety and the requirements that the industry needs to meet. Yes, the industry should pay for it, part of the polluter pays principle, but they shouldn't be in charge of deciding what it looks like.
What goes on when a nuclear safety breach happens at one of Canada's nuclear reactors?
Right, so that's about the operating nuclear power plants. And in the worst case scenario, you can have very toxic radioactive materials potentially escape the plant despite the measures that are in place to try to contain the radioactive materials in case of an accident. But there are some possibility that, you know, if things go really wrong, those radioactive materials can escape. And if that happens, you could have contamination of land around the plant. You could have contamination of drinking water. And the most immediate concern is that you can have a plume of radioactive materials escaping the plant, and then depending on weather conditions, settling over a populated area with a great deal of hazard to the population.
What are the risks to local people from accidents at the plants?
Well, the biggest risk, as I mentioned, is the most immediate consequence in the event that radioactive materials escaped. If the containment didn't hold, if something went wrong with the assumptions that went into planning for that containment, or if the accident was so bad that the plant had to let a lot more of that radioactivity out earlier in the accident sequence than they had planned when it is even more toxic. In all of those cases, the biggest issue is health effect. We work quite a bit on emergency planning at CELA, at my organization, and one of the things we've pointed out to the regulator and the emergency planners is that we need to do a much better job with one of the tools at our disposal, which is getting something called potassium iodide out into the community ahead of time so that children can ingest potassium iodide if an accident starts to occur, which would help protect against thyroid cancer. After the Chernobyl accident, that was one of the biggest impacts, was thyroid cancer. And the reason is that that's one of the radioactive substances emitted early in an accident sequence from something like a CANDU nuclear plant. Other kinds of contamination are also very significant in terms of longer-term health effects, and you really want to have an approach where the population is protected from being exposed to those things.
Why should we be concerned about small modular nuclear reactors in Ontario and New Brunswick?
So small modular reactors are an idea that the nuclear industry is putting forward, where they have, on paper, put forward the idea that they could have new nuclear power that is smaller in scale and can be assembled remotely and then brought to remote communities or less remote communities. That's why they call it modular. And they even talk in some of them about not having the necessity for operators. The point of concern is that some of the technologies they're thinking about would involve enriched uranium, which is even more hazardous, both in terms of waste handling and in terms of the potential for diversion to malicious purposes like weapons. And we haven't used enriched uranium so far in the Canadian nuclear power system. We've only used natural uranium. Another worry is that you would then be putting nuclear waste in a number of additional locations, especially if they pursue the ideas they've floated around taking it to remote communities or off-grid communities or to mining communities, for example. And now you take an already tough nuclear waste problem and you start to make it much, much worse. And then in addition, you're shipping those materials, you know, on in additional transportation routes all over the country if they were to pursue this technology. And also we would say that small modular reactors are a dangerous distraction from needing to deal with climate change. And that's part of the way the industry is trying to sell this technology and seeking and receiving large amounts of government research money in order to pursue these ideas, that they argue that they can help with climate change. But in fact, that's not the case. The scale, the cost, the lack of even available technology, in addition to all of these other risks, makes it completely non-feasible as a climate change solution.
If our listeners want to learn more about nuclear safety and Canada's policies concerning nuclear safety, where should they go?
One good place to go is the Nuclear Waste Watch website. Another good place to go is the, especially for your Montreal listeners, the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility has a good set of historical materials. The CELA website, CELA.ca, has quite a bit of information about emergency planning. And the Greenpeace website has quite a bit of information from the safety licensing hearings that they've weighed in on.
Well, thank you for your interview today.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Teresa McClenahan speaking about a petition for nuclear safety.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labour.
This is a Radio Labour Canada report recorded on Friday, February 26, 2021. I'm Marc Boulanger. In the report this week, a Supreme Court ruling in the United Kingdom could help Uber and other gig workers in Canada. Why the Second City comedy trainers are unionizing. The Labour Start report about union events and singing.
Young man, we all need unity, yes. Young man, don't you want security? I say, woman, you're the force that we need to fight injustice.
This is Radio Labour. Drivers for the ride-hailing company Uber in Canada are reporting that their wages are poor and undependable. A survey conducted by the company itself showed that 25% of the drivers described the income they earn as poor. 75% said the income was undependable, all of which points to the importance of a recent ruling by the Supreme Court in the United Kingdom. The court ruled that Uber drivers should be considered workers employed by the company and not independent contractors, as Uber insists. This could have profound implications for Uber drivers in Canada. To find out more about the UK Supreme Court ruling and its possible consequences for Canadian gig workers, I talked to Ruwan Subasinga. Mr. Subasinga, who is based in Montreal, is the legal director for the International Transport Workers Federation. The ITF represents almost 20 million union members around the world, including members of Unifor and the Seafarers International Union of Canada. I asked Mr. Subasinga to explain the ruling of the UK Supreme Court.
This case basically centered on two drivers, Yassine Aslam and James Farah, who are the lead claimants in this case, who took Uber to court on behalf of a group of 23 other drivers claiming that they are workers. And worker status is the intermediary category between employee and the self-employed under English law. And worker status basically requires a contract for services and is still a form of self-employment, but one that guarantees fundamental workers' rights like the minimum wage, holiday pay, and protection against discrimination. And the workers won in the Employment Tribunal, which is the court of first instance for employment claims in the UK. But of course, Uber appealed, and the Supreme Court really represented the fourth and final time Uber could argue that their drivers are self-employed partners rather than workers. However, the unanimous decision of the Supreme Court was that it agreed with the Employment Tribunal, the Employment Appeal Tribunal, and the Court of Appeal that drivers are workers rather than self-employed independent contractors. Now, again, I think it's important to highlight that this was a unanimous decision with no judges dissenting, and the fact that the Supreme Court reiterated the level of control Uber has over its drivers by setting fares, by having the power to deactivate drivers who don't accept rides, by using the rating given to drivers to manage their performance, and so on. And I think that a really important part of the judgment was that the Supreme Court basically guided lower courts to actually look at the working arrangements themselves as opposed to relying on contract language that would purport to classify drivers as independent contractors. And in doing this, they held that the purpose of employment protection legislation is precisely to protect workers who are paid too little for the work that they do, who work excessive hours, so on and so forth. And I think that this is particularly important when we, you know, bear in mind the gig economy and the situation gig workers are placed in. And one final point, and I think this is also a critical one, is that the Supreme Court agreed with the employment tribunal that working time extends to periods when the drivers are logged into the Uber app and not only when they're carrying passengers. And this, of course, is huge if you consider the amount of time drivers have to cruise looking for passengers. So overall, a pretty incredible ruling from the UK Supreme Court.
Does the ruling have implications for how Uber drivers will be treated in Canada?
Certainly. The Canadian Supreme Court regularly relies on decisions of the UK courts, and they've certainly cited cases from UK courts before. And if we look at the 2015 decision from the Canadian Supreme Court related to the right to strike in Saskatchewan public sector, they'd already cited numerous cases from the UK. So we would certainly think that any similar cases litigated in Canada would benefit from this ruling. I know that there are several cases already pending before the court. So we're very hopeful that this precedent will be used appropriately and correctly by the Canadian courts.
Okay, this is no joke, and the punchline is about decent working conditions, Seymourie Ainsborough reports.
Educators at the Second City Comedy Training Center in Toronto are unionizing. The nearly 100 educators voted to join the media union CWA Canada. The Second City is famous for having alumni such as Mike Myers, Catherine O'Hara, Eugene Levy, Andrea Martin, and Dan Aykroyd. It has main stage theaters in Toronto and Chicago, comedy and film training schools, and a corporate division that offers online training and education. Its workers provide instruction in comedy, music, film, writing, and improvisation, as well as kids and wellness programming. 200 workers employed by the Second City in the United States are also unionizing. When certified, the Canadian and American workers will form the Association of International Comedy Educators. Paul Bates, a faculty member who's on the organizing committee in Toronto, said a union at the Second City Training Center will go a long way to improve not just the work environment for our instructors, but also the learning environment for our students, who depend on a safe, accessible place to learn and clear lines of communication. This is Seymourie Ainsborough reporting for Radio Labour.
Here with his report about union events is Labour Star correspondent Derek Blackadder.
Some of the big stories on our Canadian news pages this week included the death of Brian Brennan, a much-respected Alberta trade union activist best known for leading the guild strike at the Calgary Herald. Also from Alberta, and almost as sad, is the news that hundreds of healthcare workers there have been suspended for their participation in a wildcat earlier this year. And we also carried big stories about the push for paid sick days in several provinces and three, count them, three lockouts in Ontario and another one coming in BC. Not really a top priority story, but well worth mentioning is the coming start of Brian Conway's trial for assault. Brian leads the section of QP 5167 that represents outside workers in the city of Hamilton, Ontario, and he is accused of striking a member of the Proud Boys, who is in turn attacking a Hamilton Pride event. The Proud Boys, you may recall, were recently declared to be a terrorist organization by the federal government. If an appeal goes out for Brian's defense fund, you'll hear about it here. Canadian labor history items on our site for this week included the 1891 Spring Hill mine explosion that took the lives of 125 men and boys in the province's largest coal mine disaster. They left more than 200 widows and children. This was just one of several such disasters that struck this small mining community over the years. On a happier historical note, in 1979, the Farm Workers Organizing Committee was founded in the New Westminster Public Library. Amongst the Canadian stories on our Working Women page this week were the daycare crisis faced by nurses in Newfoundland and Labrador and by women teachers in Alberta. Ken Kahn on our Global Health and Safety Newswire included coverage of the incorporation of the British Columbia Healthcare Occupational Safety Society, the continuing fallout from the COVID-19 outbreak at a large Ontario postal facility, and the death of a CUPW member who worked there, and why Newfoundland and Labrador workers are still being denied the right to work from home. Globally, the big stories we covered included the general strike against the coup in Myanmar, the coming general strike in South Africa as unions there demand the nationalization of key industries and a national living wage, and the imprisonment of yet another labor activist in Iran. Not considered a high-priority story by labor-starved volunteers in much of the world, but attention getting to Canadians is the push for a four-day work week in much of the rest of the so-called developed world. Unions in Iceland, Spain, and elsewhere are making significant progress in this direction by arguing that it should be part of the economic recovery from the pandemic. Current campaigns that we're running at the request of unions around the world include an urgent appeal for online solidarity with trade unionists working for a food delivery service in Israel. Look for details of this and other campaigns on our site. This is Derek Blackadder from Labor Start, reporting for Radio Labor.
Now here is Union Nation with UNION.
Young man, don't you want security? I say, woman, you're the force that we need to fight injustice for our rights. Woman, you're a leader of today. I say, women, we are paving the way for our future with our negotiating style to protect the rank and file. It's fun to be in the my union can supply all your needs. Educated is what we want you to be about. Your rights, your fight, are my young man. This ain't no YMCA, I say, sister. I'm talking jobs, equal pay. I say, come on, hurry up, don't delay. You can finally have your say. It's fun to be in the to be in love. When
Union Nation is a production of the International Association of Machinists, the IAM. And that's it. Labor news you can use. You can find our international features and daily newscasts at radiolabor.net. Follow us on Twitter at Radio Labor. I'm Mark Belanger. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about solidarity.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends are prohibited, and travel between regions should be avoided. In red zones, it's also forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the specific measures addressing the situation. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Tonight, sweetie, I'm making you your favorite meal. It's the least I can do after an entire week of taking away your phone, going through your messages, calling you names, insulting your friends, and shouting at you. Yeah, tonight, I'm making you your favorite meal so I can start another week of taking away your phone, going through your messages, calling you names, insulting your...
Violence against women stops here. Contact SOS Violence Conjugale. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
HB 531 is textbook voter suppression. This bill reduces, restricts, and limits every single aspect of our elections.
Voting rights are under attack. The Georgia House has passed a sweeping bill to make it harder to vote. This comes as Republican lawmakers in 43 states have introduced over 250 bills to restrict voting access. And today, the Supreme Court considers gutting the Voting Rights Act even more. We'll speak with Ari Berman of Mother Jones. Then as the rollout of Johnson & Johnson vaccines begin today, we look at the racial vaccination gap. Black Americans are not only twice as likely to die of COVID-19 as white Americans, but also dying at rates similar to those of white Americans who are 10 years older. We'll speak with Dr. Oni Blackstone about her call to lower the age cutoff for vaccine eligibility for Black Americans. Then, as the pandemic raged, abortion access nearly flickered out.
Abortion access was in crisis before the pandemic hit. And what we've seen over the past year is the collision of a deadly pandemic with many years' worth of state laws aimed at making access to abortion as difficult as possible. And so the COVID pandemic, in many ways, has offered us a preview of what it will be like when the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade.
We'll speak to investigative journalist Amy Littlefield. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Governors around the United States have begun rolling back restrictions aimed at slowing the spread of COVID-19, even as the United States recorded another 58,000 new infections and 1,500 COVID-19 deaths Monday. Daily cases are down from January's record highs, but have plateaued at rates comparable with last summer's peak. The Centers for Disease Control Director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, warned Monday steps to reopen public spaces may be coming too soon.
We cannot be resigned to 70,000 cases a day, 2,000 daily.